Good morning.
Good morning.
Does it seem a little warm in here? Or is maybe opening a couple of windows just a crack might be a good idea? Maybe it's just me wearing a lot of stuff. Thanks. Feels better already. So, this morning, I've chosen a case from The Gateless Barrier, also known as the Mumenkan. That's this book here. This is a collection of cases from China from close to 1,000 years ago. This translation and this commentary are by Robert Aitken. And usually these cases, as many of you know, are encounters between a master and a student. And they have a teaching function. Sometimes they are assigned to students who will sit with them, who will sit in meditation, holding the case in their mind, and it brings them somewhere. Sometimes we just use these for teaching, as I'm doing this morning. So it's on your program. Some of you have a program. I'm just going to read it through. You can follow along if you'd like. If you don't have a program, no problem. I'll repeat this enough times. So the case is the Buddha responds to an outsider. And here is the case. An outsider asked the world-honored one, "I do not ask for the spoken. I do not ask for the unspoken." The world-honored one just sat still. The outsider praised him, saying, "The world-honored one with his great compassion and mercy has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way." He then made bows and took his leave. Ananda asked, "What did that outsider realize to make him praise you?" The world-honored one said, "He is like the fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip." And then Wu Men's comment, "Ananda is the Buddha's disciple, but his realization is less than the outsider's. Now tell me, how do they differ, the disciple and the outsider?" Wu Men's verse, "Walking along the edge of the sword, running along the ridge of an iceberg, no steps, no ladders, jumping from the cliff with hands open." So the first time through, this may seem like nonsense, and if I really do my job this morning, it'll still feel like nonsense when we've finished. So I'm going to go through it line by line. It starts out, "An outsider asked the world-honored one, 'I do not ask for the spoken, I do not ask for the unspoken.' The world-honored one just sat still." This, I think, is perfect. This is perfect as it is. Well, there's one hint of imperfection. That's the word outsider, and I'll talk about that more later. But leaving aside that hint for now, I think this is like the end zone. This is like that perfect circle, which is the simplest of all Zen brush painting. This lacks nothing, and there's nothing we need to add to it. And I would kind of just like to end my talk right here. I hesitate to use any words at all. Sometimes I get a little tired of using words. But you have to say something. So here we go. So the outsider, according to Aitken, literally means one outside the way. So this is probably somebody who follows another religious tradition, one of the traditions that was popular in India at that time. But he comes to see the Buddha. That's who the world-honored one is. That's Shakyamuni Buddha. And this outsider may not be a follower of the Buddha, but he seems to be pretty advanced in whatever practice he's in, because he seems to get to the heart of the Buddha's teaching. And I don't think that's all that astonishing. Sometimes people do get to the heart of the Buddha's teaching, or get to the same place the Buddha did on their own. Doesn't happen too often, but it does happen. And it certainly happens that people through other religious traditions get to the same truth that the Buddha got to. He says, "I do not ask for the spoken, I do not ask for the unspoken." You know, I think the fall is so beautiful, this weather that we have. I've been enjoying it so much this year, just seeing the leaves outside the Founders Hall here, which are kind of a pale green, pale yellow, and a hint of pale red. They're just so beautiful. And there's that soft fall light. And the fall has always been a season that seems particularly magical to me. You might think spring is more magical. That's when life begins. That seems miraculous when the dead world comes to life. But it's fall, when things are actually dying, that stirs something really deep in me. And why would that be? Is life more precious when it's waning, when it's going away? I think maybe so. And I think maybe I'm going to enjoy my old age. We'll see. I think of the beauty of my grandparents' hands. Is there anything more beautiful than the hands of a very old person? Or I think of the beauty of a really, really old tree that's been all busted up, but it's still alive. You know, maybe most of its great branches or trunks are gone, or maybe some of them are dead, but there's still that life there, and there's such beauty in it. And I think of the bright yellow leaves and the bright red leaves on the sidewalk, or swirling gently down from the trees, or maybe blowing past on a blustery day, on a wet, blustery day. And I think of the way things open up when the leaves have fallen and you can see the outline of the landscape and how different that is. And the quality of that light. There's something so pale about that light sometimes. It's not like that bright light of summer at all. It's like something of the twilight, which is my favorite part of the day, has seeped into the entirety of the day. And I think when we see this kind of light, we draw within ourselves a little bit, even as the world gently draws us out toward it. I think October, it holds you, and it speaks very softly, and it's the most intimate of all the seasons. I do not ask for the spoken. What is the spoken? What's he talking about? That's everything I've just said about the fall. It's the words. My words about October may bring to mind October, but they are not October. In trying to be kind to October, maybe to win its friendship, I'm reducing it. I'm reducing it to words. Words about how October feels to me, not words about how October is. Once someone said to me, I wish October could last for about 5 months, because it's my favorite time of the year. And I've repeated that many times since. And then at one point I thought about and thought, you know, that's really not right. That's not only reducing October to the spoken, but that's going beyond it, trying to grasp it, trying to keep it. And of course, it's because October is so fleeting that it's beautiful. So this outsider comes to the Buddha and he doesn't ask for the spoken. And don't we love that about the outsider? Don't we love the way we can let things be in this moment, the way he can let things be in this moment? He can leave October be. Don't we get tired of words sometimes? And wouldn't we love to be free of them? Wouldn't we love to let go of this is how October feels to me? To let go of the self so that we're the bright leaves on the sidewalk, so that we just are that light. I do not ask for the unspoken. What is the unspoken? That's what I just said about the light. It's the lack of words. It's just being. It's no trace of Ted. It's October, pure and simple, and there are no words to be found, and there's a joy in that. And when we try to imagine that from the outside, we think it might be kind of an ecstatic joy, kind of an ecstasy. But when you see it from the inside, which we all do now and then, even if we don't know we're seeing it, it's much quieter than that. The leaf does not exclaim. I do not ask for the spoken, I do not ask for the unspoken. This outsider doesn't want to be limited by words, nor does he want to be limited by the absence of words. He recognizes it's not that it should be spoken, it's not that it should be unspoken. It's not that it should be neither of these, it's not that it should be both of these. So what would the outsider's October be? It's not any of those things, and it's not even none of those things. It's just... The world-honored one just sat still. This is perfect, if I may reduce it to a word. It's perfect. The world-honored one just sat still. If it's neither spoken nor unspoken, what do you do? Any word, any idea, any concept, any phrase would shatter what this outsider has brought to the Buddha. The Buddha sat still. The Buddha sat in repose. What is repose? Repose is not the spoken or the unspoken or both of these things or neither. Repose seeks no answer. And here the Buddha is being a great teacher. We can talk about things endlessly, and we do. I could talk about this by saying, well, on one level, sure, there is this practical you that must exist in the world, and we have to take care of things, and we have to pay attention to that, and we need to understand October and plan our October and maybe try to convey the magnificence of it to someone else. But on another level, there is no you, all things are interdependent, and you can let go of all the words. And somehow these two things are the same. And yet they're different, and you must try to hold them in your mind at the same time. And think about Genjo Koan, they come together in ritual, that's where we can learn. I talk about these things in those terms a lot. And sometimes, to be honest, I get a little tired of talking about it that way. The Buddha just sits still. I could be a better teacher by just sweeping. That's the real teaching. So, back to the case. The outsider praised him, saying, "The world-honored one with his great compassion and mercy has opened the clouds of my delusion and enabled me to enter the way." He then made bows and took his leave. So we could take this as an indication that the outsider has suddenly been enlightened, and some commentators see it that way. I think that his statement when he comes to the Buddha indicates that he's already a very highly realized person. He says, "I'm not looking for anything." And I think the Buddha merely confirmed that he was a highly realized person. With this line, when the outsider tells the Buddha that he's no longer deluded, does he back off a little from, "I do not ask for the spoken, I do not ask for the non-spoken"? Now he acknowledges that there is delusion, and he acknowledges that there is a way. They're two different things. He's speaking now, I think. He uses the word "me." He engages in the social act of thanking the Buddha. Is this the spoken now? Or is this the spoken imbued with the knowledge of the unspoken? Let's not ask. I think it's just the perfect thing to say. Things are still perfect. Thank you, Buddha. We're still in the realm of the Enzo here. And now continuing, Ananda asked, "What did that outsider realize to make him praise you?" Okay, now we're getting to it. Now there's some conflict. Now there's a problem, something we can learn from. So Ananda is there because he's the Buddha's attendant. He's been the Buddha's attendant for years. He's a faithful servant, and he's a devoted practitioner, but he's not yet enlightened. He hasn't penetrated the deep teachings of the Buddha. And because he's not enlightened yet, sometimes he shows up in these stories as a kind of a straight man, kind of the guy who gets it wrong. But we don't feel so bad about that because we know the history. We know that eventually, after the Buddha's death, he's going to become enlightened and he's going to be a great teacher. So he's in this place we've all found ourselves, of being the student. And he asks, pretty innocently and pretty sincerely, what did that outsider realize to make him praise you? And remember I said that there's kind of a hint of imperfection at the beginning of the case, and that hint was the use of the word outsider. The entire first part of this case is about things at ease, no spoken, no unspoken, and the Buddha sitting in repose. Except for that one word, outsider. That's not about ease. That's about insiders and outsiders. That's about things being different. And we can so easily imagine this on the human level. Imagine Ananda being a little hurt. What did that outsider realize? Ananda didn't have to use that word outsider. He did that intentionally. He's probably thinking, well, I'm an insider. I'm the ultimate insider here. I am the Buddha's attendant. I'm with him more than anyone else. And I'm not enlightened. And here comes this guy who's never even seen the Buddha before. And immediately he either is enlightened or his enlightenment is confirmed. Or at least that's what appears to be going on. I don't really know. I can't see this. Is he realized or not realized? What's the deal here? And here is the Buddha's reply. The world-honored one said, he is like the fine horse that runs even at the shadow of the whip. Okay, we need a little background here because this is a reference to a story that's popular in Zen. So Aitken tells this story in one way based on the Anguttara Nikaya, and Shinryu Suzuki tells it another way in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and I'm drawing from both versions. So there are four types of horses. Some are more useful to us than others, so some are better horses than others. Okay, we're in the world of comparison here. The best one will run at the driver's will when he just sees the shadow of the whip. That's all it takes. He's a good horse. The second best one will run when it feels just the touch of the whip. The third best, or you could say the second worst, will run when it feels pain. And the worst horse will run only when the pain penetrates the marrow of its bones. Sorry for the harshness of this image. And the Buddha compares these four types of horses to four types of practitioners. He uses the idea that fear of death will spur us in our practice. That some of us get this point faster than others. And he says the one who learns that someone in another village is about to die and then gets serious about the practice is like the best horse. The one who learns that someone in her own village is about to die and then gets serious about practice is the second best horse. The one who has to learn about someone dying in their own family to get serious about practice is the third best horse or the second worst horse. And the one who doesn't get serious until faced with his or her very own death is like the worst horse. So pretty thick and pretty slow. So we have the outsider who shows up and asks neither for the spoken nor the unspoken. And we have the Buddha who is still. All is in repose except for that hint, this word outsider. There was no room originally for best or worst horse. The outsider, you couldn't imagine this outsider saying, hey, I'm a pretty good horse. You couldn't imagine the outsider saying, this is really a beautiful fall day or a beautiful dry season day. And I hope tomorrow is just the same, and I hope the dry season lasts all year. And you can't imagine the Buddha saying something back to him at the beginning of this case. But then Ananda asks this question and shatters the repose, you could say. But what about inside and outside? What about enlightenment and non-enlightenment? What about me versus the outsider? What about the spoken and the unspoken? And I think that the Buddha's answer to Ananda is really perplexing. I had a hard time with this, which is what made this case really interesting to me. He says, the outsider is like the fine horse who runs even at the shadow of the whip. He's basically saying to Ananda, there are good students and bad students. The outsider is a good student. And since you have to ask that question, Ananda, it's clear the outsider is a better student than you are. And when I think of poor Ananda hearing that, I think he must have felt a lot of pain. And that's what's perplexing. Why would the Buddha do that? Why didn't he say something really nice to Ananda? And before I go further, I'd like to explore a bit this good horse, bad horse distinction. And in order to do that, I have to enter into the distinction a bit. But before I do that, I would like you to keep in mind these questions. Is this distinction real? Is it not real? Is it neither? Or is it both? So Suzuki takes a very clear approach to this, and he's very, very kind in talking about the sense in which this distinction is not real. And he says it better than I could, so I'm just going to read it. First, I'm going to say that cool air feels really good, but if anyone's feeling really cold, just go ahead and get up and close these windows. He says, when we hear this story, almost all of us want to be the best horse, right? If it is impossible to be the best horse, we want to be the second best. This is, I think, the usual understanding of this story and of Zen. Here, however, there is a misunderstanding of Zen. If you think the aim of Zen practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you will have a big problem. This is not the right understanding. If you practice Zen in the right way, it does not matter whether you are the best horse or the worst one. When you consider the mercy of Buddha, how do you think Buddha will feel about the four kinds of horses? He will have more sympathy for the worst one than for the best one. When you are determined to practice Zazen with the great mind of Buddha, you will find the worst horse is the most valuable one. In your very imperfections, you will find the basis for your firm, way-seeking mind. The very thing that holds you back can be the thing. Those who can sit perfectly physically usually take more time to obtain the true way of Zen, the actual feeling of Zen, the marrow of Zen. But those who find great difficulties in practicing Zen will find more meaning in it. So I think that sometimes the best horse may be the worst horse, and the worst horse can be the best horse. And I think it's very hard for us to accept what Suzuki is saying here. We may accept it in our minds, but to really get it in our bones, that's a very difficult thing. We compare our practice to that of others, and we compare our practice to some idea of what it should be, what we think it should be, all of the time. And I think this results in real suffering. I see it. We might say things like, you know, I've been practicing for a whole year and I cannot get one quiet minute. Or I've been practicing for 5 years and I've still not had anything that feels like a breakthrough. I don't know what's going on. Or everyone else seems so calm and I'm such a mess. That's a really common one. Everyone says that, which is kind of funny. But this makes me so sad because it's so unnecessary to make these comparisons. I mean, is there a place that's better than where we are? Is there some other place? Is there some other world or realm that's better than this that we're trying to get to? What is it we want? Is it the spoken? Is it the non-spoken? Do we want it always to be fall? Is it that we're ready to recognize that everything is interdependent and there are no absolutes, except there's one exception, and that exception applies to the quality of my practice? Come on! There can't be an exception for the quality of our practice. Quality of your practice is not even a useful phrase. Practice, is practice. Either you do it or you don't. In this moment, if I have your full attention, we're practicing together. We're just doing it. We're not doing it in degrees, right? It's happening. You know, the world is present here. Practice is going on. Let's not ruin it by thinking, well, maybe it should be a little different, you know. It's just this. Even if I say the wrong thing, it gets really stupid. It's still this. That's okay. The best horses I know are two people in my family. And these are the two people I know who struggle the most, who have really severe problems. One has severe brain damage, and the other has a severe mental illness. And they're also the two, I think, sweetest and kindest people I know. And you could say they're the worst horses. You could say that they're the best horses because they're the worst horses. But of course they're neither. They're horses. Just like we're all horses. What am I saying to them if I say there are these levels of horse quality? There are good horses and bad horses. Am I saying, well, you're the bad horses? I can't say that. And what if I say to one of my relatives who's really highly accomplished, you're a really good horse and I like that about you? Well, does that mean if they stop being a good horse, I'm not going to love them anymore? Of course it doesn't mean that. So it pains me when I know that someone is suffering because they question the quality of their practice. And all I can say is, please believe me, you're a horse. You're the horse that you are. And if you can just let yourself be that horse, then you can just let all the other horses be too. Do you see how letting yourself be is letting all beings be? Okay, so that is Suzuki's approach with a little more that I added. And it's a very kind approach, and I love to talk about it this way. But Aitken takes a different approach when he says in his commentary that it's true that Ananda's realization is less than the outsider's. That's true, he says. He continues, very troublesome for Ananda, very troublesome for anyone else in this situation. The perfection of patience fulfills the practice, however. It's a little kindness at the end. You know, be patient, Ananda. You'll get there. But he's saying, you know, there are better and worse horses. So which is it? Is Suzuki right and Aitken wrong? Or vice versa? Are there distinctions between horses or not? I certainly would like to believe that there are no distinctions, and I know that's true in a way, but Aitken is also right. We can make distinctions about how our practice is now and how it was then. So back to the case. Why does the Buddha answer Ananda in this way? Why does he mention the horses and jump into the world of distinctions with Ananda? Why doesn't he just sit in silence again? Why doesn't he say, no, Ananda, it's not that, and it's not that? Or please don't ask that question, or please don't look for an answer. Wouldn't that be a better teaching for Ananda? Well, I have two possible explanations for this. And the first is that the Buddha is using what we call in Zen skillful means. A good teacher says something that will help that particular student at that particular time. And the Buddha knows Ananda really well. The Buddha knows that sometimes Ananda really needs some kindness, and he knows that sometimes Ananda needs a little encouragement in his practice, a little discipline, and even pointing out where he's wrong. And he knows that Ananda can't yet see the things the way the outsider could see them. He knows Ananda has great potential, but he's not ready for that deep teaching. And furthermore, he must know that what he needs right now is not comforting, but a spur, so to speak, going back to the horse metaphor, to practice harder. So the Buddha says, in effect, I think you're being a little whiny, Ananda. You got to practice harder, Ananda. Painful, but sometimes it's the teacher's job to do that. The other explanation for why the Buddha would say such a thing to Ananda is that maybe we shouldn't think about this as an actual exchange between a real teacher and a real student and worry about how they felt and worry about Ananda's feelings, because this is a teaching for us. Many of these stories, these cases, are pretty harsh. Sometimes they even get violent. You know, someone's been known to lose a limb to a sword or something. But I don't think we should take the harshness or the violence too literally. These stories are not about saying it's okay for the master to hit the student, or even that this stuff really happened. These are just teaching aids designed to get our attention. And if we look at it this way, we can allow for the possibility that the person who wrote down this case has the Buddha saying the exact opposite of what he really believes. And that happens sometimes in these cases. These cases are designed to be deeply considered by the student over a long period of time. The student will go over every possibility in the course of exhausting all possible logical approaches and getting to that point of, I give up, and getting beyond that logical approach. And encountering what the Buddha intended is one thing. Encountering the opposite of what the Buddha intended and holding that for a long time is another thing, and that can help to open you up. And we can also see this line as just being a setup for Wu Men's comment, which follows. The Buddha is pointing out the great difference between the outsider and Ananda, the insider. Perhaps he's doing that so that Wu Men can sweep it away with one thunderous question, which is coming. Not the next line. The next line is, Ananda is the Buddha's disciple, but his realization is less than the outsider's. That's not the thunderous part. That's more of the same. But here, now tell me, how do they differ, the disciple and the outsider? And this is the thunderous question. How do they differ? Or you might say, do they differ? Is there difference? What is this difference thing? What is this sameness thing? This is the question that brings us to the great chasm and has us looking deep into nothingness. How do they differ? This is the very heart of the great dilemma. Is there difference? Is there unity? Do they have a relationship? Are there best and worst horses? Or are there simply horses? Is there an answer? Should Wu Men even be asking this question? And on a beautiful fall day like this one, am I the leaves or the one who sees the leaves? The one who talks about the leaves? Am I the spoken or the unspoken? And it's the question that is the point. Not the answer, the question. And it's not asking the question exactly. It's more like holding the question. It's more like having a great openness that comes from that question being deep in your bones, deeper than words. It's bringing that question to every moment. It's not about getting an answer. It's about showing up with that incredible question. Because if you got answers, you're not there. If you're on the edge of that chasm with nothing but the great question, there you are. There you are. So at each moment, can you hold that question with your full being? Aiken says that Wu Men, in asking this question, is laying a trap for all of his tigers. Wu Men does not give us an answer. He gives us a verse. Walking along the edge of a sword. That's how I feel giving this talk. It's so easy to fall into yes or no, or yes and no, or neither yes nor no. And I may have fallen off that edge a couple of times. And if I have, I tell you, it's just because I love horses so much. So, running along the ridge of an iceberg, no steps, no ladders. This is how it is when we don't seek an answer to the question, when we stay in perpetual not knowing. Aitken says, that this is precisely following all the rules of balance and gravity, highly trained, highly disciplined, yet completely free. Precisely following all the rules of balance and gravity, highly trained, highly disciplined, yet completely free. How can you follow the rules precisely and still be completely free? That's another question. Jumping from the cliff with hands open. No inside, no outside. Not resolving the question of whether there are types of horses or just horses. Not resolving the question of whether I'm the leaf or the watcher of the leaf. More like being the question than being the leaf. And that's what I've got to say about that case. And if anyone has a comment or a question, I would certainly welcome those. If nothing comes up right away, that's okay. We can just sit for a minute. Yes?
In your question about why would Buddha say such a thing to Ananda, it reminded me of a quote from, I'm sure I'm butchering the name, but Shogyam Trungpa, the Tibetan teacher in the 60s, he said that we often, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, we often talk about compassion in terms of being kind, but really it's more about being creative to wake a person up.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was just kind of an interesting parallel.
Yes, yeah, and of course, kindness. Kindness is not always saying the thing the person wants to hear. Sometimes kindness is saying the opposite of what the person wants to hear. Yeah, that's very appropriate. Thank you. Benton.
So you talked about fall being a time of dying.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to think of it as a time of sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
The trees aren't dying, they're just going to sleep. And in the spring, they aren't coming to life, they're waking up.
Yeah, let's remember that in our old age.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, is that it then? Thank you so much for your attention.